From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Bassem Youssef, a heart surgeon from Egypt who reinvented himself as the John Stewart of the Arab world. He had never done anything like it, but his TV news satire show became a massive hit. It was also pretty risky, and he had to leave. But these days, he's making fun of politicians here in the U.S. He'll join us to talk about his new sense of activism and the role of satire in making his point. Join us after this.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bassem Youssef says before you have hate, you first have to have fear. This, he says, is what ideologues and extremists have always understood. So they'll create a fear of refugees or a fear of immigrants because we'll lose our identity. Or there's a fear of tolerance because someone will take away our principles or our beliefs. Fear, he says, has always been their best weapon. But Youssef has found that over time, satire is a great antidote to fear. Because when you laugh, he says, you're not afraid anymore. Bassem Youssef understands satire pretty well at this point because he's been doing it for tens of millions of people now. In Egypt, he hosted an incredibly popular news satire show. He's the subject of the documentary film Tickling Giants. Here in the U.S., he hosted a satirical series called Democracy Handbook, and he's written a book called Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring, which he did manage to do, laugh through the Arab Spring before he was charged with insulting Egypt's leaders and Islam. One of the chapter titles in his book is To Flee or Not to Flee. He was told it might be a good idea to leave Egypt, and so he did. Bassem Youssef was in Utah this week performing a one-man show, and he joined us at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. I wanted to ask you about the time, your time as a heart surgeon. Were you a good one?
I mean, I was okay. I mean, I did the job. I cut them open. I closed them back in and, you know, sewed them back. I had a lot of experience. I was an attending doctor. I passed the American license exams, and I was accepted in a fellowship in Cleveland. That never happened. Thank God. And that was all like before the revolution.
One of the things you've written about in your book is that before 2011, the Arab Spring, that you were politically apathetic.
Yes. The thing is, when you are living under the same president for 30 years, you become apathetic. And and that's not just me, everybody. It's kind of like you wake up and it's the same thing every day. So you become indifferent. And this is why this is one of the criticism that we would have from the anti-revolution people. It's like, where were you before 2011? It's like, where were you? Everybody was apathetic. And the thing is, and the reason for this, and this is something that only people who lived under dictatorship will feel. And I think that you guys need to relate to this. When you feel that you don't have a stake in your own country, you stop caring. But when you know that your actions matter and your voice matter and your vote matters, this is where you become active. So we were told, not just told, but we were shown from a very young age, is like, no matter what we do, nothing will change. So we're put into this mindset. And this is what regimes in the Middle East have been very good at, that they have found a way in always marginalizing, sidelining the young people. They know that they are their greatest enemies. So they use different ways. They use fear. They use oppression. They use despair. Despair is a very, very good weapon. And they use religion. Religion is very effective. So, for example, in the end of 80s and the beginning of 90s, there was like a whole movement of a government-sanctioned patronage of the Salafi movement, which is the extreme Islamists. They were like more extreme than the Muslim Brotherhood. And basically, they used very extreme interpretation of democracy is haram, democracy is forbidden, and we should not participate in the democratic process, so we should just like stay on the sidelines until the promise of the caliphate comes. So this was very effective, and this was sanctioned by the government because you have all of these young people who just become religious and they don't participate and they don't vote, but it will somehow backfire. So the whole thing about radicalism in the Middle East, it is not military secularism against Islamic radicalism. Both of them are actually the product of each other. The military creates the Islamist movement in order to protect itself, and then it blows up in its face. And then when that happens, they go and tell the West that like it's either us or them. So it's really by design.
Well, this is the story you tell in your book about the moment when you got caught up in the fervor of the Arab Spring for the first time. You were a doctor, and I think if I have this image right, you were in a white coat in the street. Not you didn't do this very well, but throwing your first stone.
Oh yes, yes. I was doing a lot of work in the makeshift clinics in Tahrir Square, but I really wanted to take part of the action. I was kind of like jealous because I'm not really a violent person, but I wanted to really go into, you know, take a piece of what they're taking. So I went to in front of the confrontation line and I found a stone, a rock, and I wanted to throw it to the thugs, but like as I threw it, it slipped my hand and it hit the back of one of our own. And so it's basically, I mean, I was good enough to be, at that moment, the quarterback of the Cleveland Browns. And I missed so bad. And I went back to the makeshift clinics in order to heal wounds instead of causing them. And yeah, that was my most violent moment in the Arab Spring. And then I said, like, nah, it's not my thing.
It's interesting, you talked about how, in some ways, you became a doctor to please your folks, to please your mother. It wasn't exactly something you felt terribly passionate about. And I'm wondering, what were the things that you did feel passionate about? I mean, clearly, performing must have been on your mind in those early
yes,
days.
Yes. And I don't know if I mentioned my performance yesterday. I like dancing. And I danced salsa for 10 years. I was even a salsa instructor. So it's in a way that was performance.
Yeah.
And then after 2007, I switched to tango. So I did Argentinian tango for another 12 years now. And I also taught tango. I was a DJ for tango. And I did all of that by as being a doctor. So for me, it was more of an outlet as kind of like it just, you try to find something that you like. And it seems that I like two things, performing and teaching people. So I was a better teacher than a dancer, and I enjoy teaching people, teaching them the basic and how to listen to the music and stuff like that, and I don't know if that directly or indirectly affected my career afterwards as a performer and doing comedy, because in doing comedy I don't really do one-liner jokes and just easy one. I wanted to do it with a message in a way to reach people. So maybe that affected my career as a comedian.
When you had this incredibly popular YouTube channel before you had the show, and you were this really hot property, and people who found your YouTube channel, there were like six different TV channels in Egypt who wanted you, and you turned them all down. But you decided to go with one particular independent channel, mm-hmm. who controversially had a Christian owner. Mm-hmm. This was always kind of a bit of a problem you've talked about. But talk a little bit about the kind of show you were thinking about, the kind of show that you you wanted.
So the reason that I turned down the other TV channels, first of all, this was something unheard of, to have someone from a YouTube channel converting into television. So they dealt with me on the fact that I was an anomaly, and you should be thankful for whatever money that we give you. And you can just like do, and they wanted me as a filler. Just do the same thing you do on YouTube. And I said, no, if you're going to go to a bigger screen, the show has to be bigger and it has to be a better budget. Not because I wanted more money, but in order to have quality, you have to spend on quality. And they kind of walked away. It's like, yeah, you're just like being arrogant. It's like, no, this is like the way you do business. This is, you're just like used to paying very little money. That's why the quality on Egyptian television was horrible. And I always say that we were stuck in the 80s in the television before 2011. And then that channel, even that channel, the one it was called On TV, and it had a good track record during the revolution. So I had like a certain affinity to it. And even that, the manager of the channel treated me the same way, but it was not until the owner who interfered and said, like, you know, I don't think we're going to make money out of you, but like, I like your message, so go. So they basically, instead of giving me a 2 years contract, they gave me 1 year contract. But they didn't see that the show blew up, and now they regretted the fact that they didn't lock me in for 2 years. But by the time that ended, I said, like, I don't want to do recorded shows anymore. I want to do a live audience in a real theater. And everybody laughed me off, because that was not the ways things were happening in Egypt or even the Arab world. So maybe this is one thing I'm proud of. So when people tell me, what is the most thing that you're proud of? I don't talk about fighting against dictatorship. I don't talk about making fun of authority. I'm very proud of the fact that we have changed how television looked like. Until now, even if political satire shows are not allowed, but even the look and the feel of the shows, people now understand that you need to pay money to get good quality. So the quality of the shows have actually increased a lot after 2011, and I think that we had a huge part of it. But to get back to that, to On TV, that was very controversial because, I mean, the guy didn't care. The guy didn't really interfere in my work. But since the rise of my show happened the same time with the rise of the Islamists, that was my Achilles heel. Oh, you're being paid by the Christian in order to make fun of the Islamist. And even when I left them and I went to another channel, they found another way in order to accuse me of whatever accusation they want. It's a whatever accusation, fake news, enemy of the people, you name it. We have our equivalents.
Well, you had an opportunity early on in that process to meet Jon Stewart, who
yes.
You'd always looked up to. And you talk about this meeting you had with Jon when you went to New York. Talk a little bit about that. This is what you write in your book. You said, when we compared the politics of hate and xenophobia in both of our countries, we found things to be sadly similar.
Yes, very. I mean, I think extreme right wing are the same everywhere, whether they are based on nationalism or based on religion. The GOP is in a unique position that they have the best of both, or the worst of both. In Egypt, it's kind of split. You either have the Muslim Brotherhood or the military, but even now, even the military have its own tinge of religion. But it is the same thing. The thing is that these people have really nothing going on for them other than spreading hate and fear, because if you look, for example, for Donald Trump, and we had this meeting way before Donald Trump came to power, but they were like, everything that was happening there was basically paving the way for Donald Trump. You know, at that time there was Sarah Palin and there was the Tea Party, and all of that was just like paving the way. It's like, how extreme can you get on the right wing? But if you look at him, for example, which is like now the extreme form of what the GOP leadership has become, he did something that no other American president done, even the most Republicans, even Reagan, even Bush Senior or Junior. For me, he did something that really pissed me off, other than all of the stuff that he's saying every day. When he, for 2 years in a row, he said, I'm not going to, he boycotted the White House Correspondents' Dinner. For me, that was basically, seriously? I mean, you could be an asshole, but that is beyond any recognition of being an asshole, because this is, you don't understand, as a non-American, you don't understand how important this event is for people watching from outside. Because people, a lot of people don't like American policies, and a lot of people don't like American military interventions. But that day a year is the biggest skeptic, or the everybody who hates America sit there and cannot believe that the president of the United States is making fun of the press, and the press making fun of him, and they're actually paying for someone to make fun of him in front of everybody. That was like an unwritten pact.
So he basically said,
like, you know what, this is his way of saying this for me, this is his way of saying, like, I'm not a public servant and I don't care. The whole idea about the American presidency is that there is this sense of I'm not coming here to rule. I'm coming here to be a public servant, and I'm answering for the people. So, and the reason why someone, Donald Trump, is very sensitive and very quick to tweet everybody makes fun of him, is that this is the whole thing about the authoritarian figures. They do not. Can't handle people making fun of them because they really don't have anything running, going on for them. So if you have authoritarian regimes, they don't really have any achievements. They don't really have any message of what should we be, or how can we make this country better. So the only thing that's going on for them is fake respect and fear. And satire takes this away from them. And if that's it, what else has Donald Trump has? He has nothing. And of course, there's a difference. He goes and tweets, other people shut down shows. He cannot do that because the system doesn't allow him. But it's the same thing, the same mentality. And this is why satirists and cartoonists are usually one of the biggest targets. Whether these were biggest targets for authoritarian leaders or for terrorists, like the Charlie Hebdo, for example. They cannot handle satire and humor, no matter how insensitive you think it is, but you shouldn't go and kill someone or shut him down.
Do you think satire came naturally to you in some ways? One of the things you said is that Egyptians are a very satirical people.
Yeah, unless that you're making fun of them.
Right.
Yeah, I think is a normal trait. I think everybody is sensitive when satire is directed to them, but the difference is that here, you can be upset as much as you want, but you cannot change things. The system, the contract, the social contract doesn't allow you to stop it. So for me, I was not stopped because the people revolted against me. It's because the government went down and shut me down. I'm fine with people hating my show, but you should let it be organically stop. If people don't like me, people will stop watching me. The rating will go down, and it will not be worthwhile for people watching me anymore. But the idea, yes, we are very satirical, but we, like everybody, we have our own taboos. We have our own untouchable, sacred areas that we do not want to talk about. Religion is one of it. And I didn't really make fun of religion. I never made fun of religion. I made fun of the people.
Why didn't you make fun of religion?
Because I don't think it is counterproductive. Because for me, there's a bigger message. I don't really have a problem with religion. I have a problem with people using religion. So my criticism and my satire was directed against the people who represent religion and using it to gain power. I had a huge problem with the sheikhs, with those like radical sheikhs. And I made fun of them. And for that was like, all hell broke loose. And I didn't care. And I said, I will. And when I make fun of the military, that was even more sacred than religion. If you were living in Egypt long enough, you'll understand that the military is even more sacred. And I didn't even make fun of the troops. I didn't even make fun of the military. And again, I made fun of the people who use the military in order to gain power. It's the same here. When somebody kneels to the national anthem, he's not disrespecting the troops. He is protesting. But they will make it about the troops. They will make it about the flag. And this is why I always say that small people hide behind big ideas. So whether you are a religious fanatic, a military authoritarian leader, a right-wing fanatic, you will hide behind those ideas because you're so small, you cannot really like stand up for your own ideas. So no, it's about the religion. And I'm okay. They would always tell you that I'm okay with freedom of speech, but you don't go there. What do you mean you don't go there? Go where? But it was not even about the flag. It was not even about the anthem. It's not even about the religion or the military. But you make it about it in order to give yourself some sort of an authority to tell people that what he's doing is wrong.
Bassem Youssef, heart surgeon, comedian. His book is Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring. Youssef was in Utah this week. He joined us at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're about to part ways with your old car, consider donating it to KUER. We'll take your vehicle in almost any condition, and we'll even arrange to pick it up. The proceeds from your donation support the KUER programs you love, like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Radio West. Learn more about our vehicle donation program at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with Bassem Youssef, a heart surgeon from Egypt who reinvented himself as the John Stewart of the Arab world. Youssef was in Utah this week. He joined us at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. I was interested about your sense of comedy and whether, like, one of the questions I had was whether or not your sense of comedy translates here. That was one question. And I want to ask you about that. But it occurred to me, can ideological conservatives be good comics? Good at comedy?
No, they can't. they can't. They definitely can't. I mean, what was his name? Dennis Miller? Dennis Miller was a great comic until he became a George Bush supporter, and he was horrible.
Why do you think that is?
Because I think comedy has... Here's the thing. Comedy and satire is a very subversive activity. You need to break the rules, and you need to get out of your comfort zone. And conservative ideology always puts limit to what can you make fun of. So that's why we had a running joke in Egypt that how the Muslim Brotherhood, they lost the people not because they were authoritarian, but because they were lame. And they are really horrible. They cannot find a single Islamist who has a good sense of humor or a single nationalist pro-military who has a good sense of humor. It's horrible. Once you put that limit on you, you're not a good comic anymore. And I'm not saying that I'm better than them. At least I'm trying, but like you have the people who really limit themselves with these social conservative construct, they're horrible, and they are not funny, and maybe they're funny for their own base. Again, you know, being humorous is something that is very subjective. Yeah. So because there is this show that sometimes I on Fox News that comes at night, and there's an older guy who's supposed to be their comic, he's like their funny guy, and it's painful to watch. It is painful to watch, and the people, they come, and I can't. And I'm not saying that, like, liberals are all funny. Some of them are also very lame, but but they're lame because they're lame, not because of the ideological thing.
Right. Did you, when you got here, was it hard to... it's being funny is so much about language sometimes and so much about getting the inside jokes and the context and everything. Does your kind of humor translate? I mean, did you struggle with that when you got here?
Big time. Yeah, because like you can speak the language very fluently, but humor is a third language. The level of humor, what kind of humor? So, for example, you will find someone who speaks... the language, okay, and he will understand friends. Friends is very easy. Slapstick, everybody gets it. But then you will have trouble understanding Frasier. And maybe even other trouble understanding Seinfeld. These are different shows. And they are different levels and different areas of comedy. So the language is one thing, but understand you can understand Arabic perfectly, but you will have no idea what just happened. And even within the Arab world, I mean, a lot of Egyptians don't understand Saudi humor, if there's one. And you don't understand that sometimes the language doesn't translate. Lebanese are very funny, but sometimes their humor don't translate to us. Egyptians are different because of the history and how, like, all of the Arab world was watching our material and our cinema for a very long time. They could understand us more. So, and I had to struggle not with the language, but with so many issues when doing comedy. So I have to rewire my brain to reset my cadence, my speed, my pausing, my pacing. There's much of the comedy that's the unspoken part of comedy that actually I have to understand. Because in Arabic, there's not like a really not well-established art of stand-up comedy in Arabic. It started just like the last 10 years. But I was never a stand-up comedy in Arabic in itself. So, and stand-up comedy, there's two things that actually that came out of America. It's jazz and stand-up comedy. So stand-up comedy is very, it's such an American, the whole thing is very American. And to understand the language is one thing, but to understand the other things that surrounds the language is totally different. You can have a killer joke, but your delivery can just like sink it. So it's I had to play with so many elements in order to try to be funnier in English, and it's not very easy.
Could you do in Egypt the equivalent of the F word in a routine?
No, I mean definitely not. Even in when I bleeped stuff in my show, it was something very, very mild. That stuff that like people use every day, and it's not. It was like far away from the F-bomb. That's why when people say, you had profanity in your show, it's like, seriously, give me an example. And they will not come up with an example. They will come up with, maybe they will remember an insinuation or two, but they will not even remember that I said a bad word on my show. Because at the end of the day, that's broadcast. You know, think about Egypt before George Carlin, before Lenny Bruce. Yeah. This is the level of media before Lenny Bruce, and even before, way before, like George Carlin said seven words you cannot say on television. So yeah, it's very conservative, and I think part of it, a huge part of it, is government control. And because of the government control, there is of course. Social backlash. But here's the thing. Here's my theory about the social backlash. I'm not saying that the only thing that preventing this is government. I think that people are also indoctrinated by it a lot. But if you let ideas flow, no matter how offensive they are, without the government interfering, people will start to accept. And people, and actually the younger people's like, hey, what's the big deal? I want here to profanity. I want to hear the F word in Arabic. You don't tell me what I do. And by that, like, you will have the older generation will be receding bit by bit. But the whole thing, this is kind of a bigger issue than just profanity. It really reflects on everything else about like letting free ideas float in the Arab world. The whole thing about like controlling people in the Middle East could really be resolved within less than one generation if the government stopped controlling and it just like and ideas flew between people. And if that happens, just like the society will correct itself and that will be allowed, and then people will now say, all right, this TV show has F-word, I don't have to watch it. Or I can watch it. I'm not going to be offended. So it's not really about profanity. The whole idea about government control really affects everything else, not just profanity.
Does it seem like in your book you use plenty of F words?
Yes.
Is it freeing? Is it weird
to employ the F word now in a culture that...
For me, the F word doesn't really mean as much as for an American. The same way that, like, if you use the F word in Arabic as an American, it doesn't mean anything to you. So, yeah, it's like, it doesn't mean, it's like I'm going to use it.
Did you know when you started the show that there was an end game, that this can't last very long?
I had this feeling a lot when the military took over. I think when the military took over, that was really the countdown of the show. With the Muslim Brotherhood, it's not because they were more democratic. It's just because they were not powerful enough to take things down. They tried, but they couldn't. But when the military came, we saw how people turned fascist overnight, and the military, which is a history of support, and they can do whatever. I mean, you know, this joke that Trump said, like, I can shoot someone in Fifth Avenue and nobody will say anything? The military can do that. The military can do that, and they will find a justification. And they did that. So when the military took over, we basically, that was the countdown.
You hear people in Utah say that whether they actually believe in Mormonism anymore or actually practice anymore, you hear people say, if asked, that they're Mormon. Is that how it is with you in some ways, that you're maybe, I don't know what you believe, frankly, but whether you're a believer or not, you still consider yourself Muslim, or is the belief still connected to the way?
Well, the thing is, like, whether you believe you're a Muslim or not, your culture is Muslim, whether you like it or not, like, yeah, the culture of Jews or whatever. But the thing is, I have deliberately stopped answering this question because this is one of the most defining questions in the Arab world, and I'm sick and tired of it. And now I come here, and now it's a defining question for me, and I am sick and tired of it. When I have discussions back in Egypt with people in Egypt, and they come, like, I don't want to actually have religion having anything with politics. It's already, religion has already spoiled politics, and politics has spoiled religion. If you want to talk to me on secular basis. And that doesn't mean that, like, we hate religion or anything. You can do whatever you want, but it doesn't affect the public opinion or the public way of doing things. And the same thing that, like, when people ask me here, it's like, yes, all right, I'm a Muslim. What do you want?
Yeah.
Right. Like, are you going to ask me if I pray five times a day, if I pay four, if I pay three? What's the cutoff? Like, do I fast? What do you care? And suddenly it becomes an issue. But I use it in my comedy. I think it's like when you actually do a show, and when you are in a minority coming from the Middle East and Arab and Muslim, that gives you more material, which is great.
Right. You say in the book that Western think tanks always get wrong how it is, you know, there's this question. What do Muslim people, what does the Muslim world, what does the Arab world, why do they hate Americans? Or what do they think about Americans?
And that's the most generic, generalized question I've ever heard.
Right. Like,
when you say the Muslim world, the Muslim people,
yeah,
it's like, why do Americans hate bacon? Is that true? No, I'm sure that Americans...
Well, but that's the question. You say, that's the thing you say in the book, is that the Western think tanks always get this wrong.
Yes.
And is that why? Because they've generalized what Muslims are, generalized what the Arab world is.
I think they get it wrong for so many reasons. First of all, since I wrote that book, I have actually come to know more about the think tanks in Washington, and I have actually formed a much stronger opinion about them, especially for the way that they get their funding, especially starting with 2013. I think that we should not listen to think tanks in Washington at all. These are tainted institutes. So just like they are hired to write these papers, whether they receive their money from Saudi Arabia or from Qatar or from United Arab Emirates or from the Israeli lobby or from Norway or from Japan. These are basically think tanks who openly receive money from abroad in order to write papers that are influenced by this money. So why am I listening to them? Why am I listening to the Brookings Institute? I mean, and it's funny when you find like a think tank that is funded by Qatar and they talk about all of the human rights violation in United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, and then there's another think tank who is funded by Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates who would talk about the human rights violations in Qatar, and nobody is talking about the other. It's weird, right? And it's really it's just like, you know, when people look at Washington, D.C. and the think tanks and the professor with the bow ties and the wool jackets and the, you have like great respect, but these are basically prostitutes for hire. I'm sorry to say this, but they are, and either with all due respect for prostitutes, but at least they're doing something right. But these people, they are doing that, and they are want you to believe that they're doing something right and scientific and political, but they're not. And I think the think tanks in Washington are one of the biggest scam in America. And it gives you, I mean, we already know how the Senate members and the House members already have their political decisions and voting are influenced by lobbying, which for me, I cannot really believe that how American voters live day to day, seeing this openly happening, and they still vote for these people. This is something I can't really get my mind around. But to have think tanks who get foreign money to affect the decision of the American government, this is. I don't know what you call this. And it's not like there is a law that's against. There's a law written against. There's an act that is written against this kind of thing. And nobody is doing it because everybody is receiving the money. And sometimes the money could be a first-class ticket to Dubai or come to our little conference in the middle of the Sahara just so we can talk about democracy. It's bullshit. This is bullshit. It's a lot of hypocrisy and a lot of it's really pressing. You know, you can expect that from a third world country, but you don't expect that from Washington, and they have been basically doing that for many years, and it's very, very depressing.
I wanted to ask you, when you went out into the American countryside in the show Democracy Handbook, how did you think about the way you wanted to interact with Trump voters or political conservatives? And I'm thinking about a particular style, Sacha Baron Cohen, for example, mm-hmm. his particular style, like his latest, Who is America, which mercilessly made fun of certain conservatives. And I'm wondering what you make of that technique, if that you also see as somehow maybe counterproductive, or when you go out, does it help to make fun of these people, or how did you think about all of that?
No, for me, he's an amazing performer, and he is, he's an intellectual comedic stuntman.
Yep.
That's what I would call him.
Yeah.
He does stuff that nobody else can do. I cannot really do what he's doing, but what I try to do is just like, I didn't kind of make fun of them. What I did is just give them the opportunity to speak their mind. So sometimes I would be in an interview and I would just like speak for them for an hour. And I just want them to show their true color. Without making fun of them, without stunting them, everything. I just want them to speak comfortably and it helps. So I think we should stop this polarity of like us against them. As Muslims against Christians against Jews, I think there should be another narrative to deal with this. There's good people everywhere and there's horrible people everywhere, and that should be the us against them. I actually feel much more in touch or in contact with someone who is a liberal Christian or a liberal atheist or a liberal Jew much more than I would feel close to a radical Islamist who want to a caliphate and blow me up. And the same way, the Jew would actually feel more in touch with people like us than with a Hasidic Jew that wants that wants the second coming of Messiah, where all the Gentiles will be their slaves. Same thing. I think that the us against them should be really all of those horrible people that want the end of the world and the rest of us, not how white or how brown or how Muslim or how Jewish or how Christian are. I think that should be like a new way of classification.
You're asked from time to time, how do you reach people who are given to believing, you know, fake news or political conspiracies? And one of the things you said is that you can't really reach them in some ways because people, this is how you put it, you said people will every time choose ideology over truth and fact.
Yeah, I kind of, this is one of the most common questions I get asked. They say, how do you reach to the people to the other side? You don't. You will not. You really won't. I mean, there is a certain threshold where you can really take this discussion anymore. And the same thing with the pro-military, the pro-Muslim Brotherhood, the pro-Trump. It's the same thing. You don't. You will not reach them. Facts don't mean anything to them. And the science don't mean anything to them. Numbers, statistics don't mean anything to them. The truth doesn't mean anything to them. So it's really futile. It's really futile. And I'm sorry like to be the bearer of bad news. And no, it's not like a kumbaya, let's all live together. Because for them, they don't want to actually get along with you. They want to dominate you. They don't care. I mean, you have seen what conservative, they call conservative, but not, they're not really conservative. They are like basically populist people. When they come to power, they don't care about democracy. They want to take over. They use democracy in order to take over and change the rules in order to put certain people down. They don't care. And that's why this is what I'm really hate about liberals, is that everything is about like, let's work together. Let's work it out. Let's get out. You don't. There is really no negotiation when it comes to humanity and human rights and people's and minorities' rights and just your right as a human. You don't negotiate these things. You don't negotiate a wall. You don't negotiate putting down refugees. You don't negotiate with people who think that all Muslims are terrorists or all Mexicans are rapists. You don't negotiate with these people. The same way, I stopped negotiating with the Muslim Brotherhood a long time ago. I don't care. I don't care if you. I'm not gonna go into some dogmatic ideology or discussion of whether or not should we cut someone's hand or not, or whether it's not the right time. That's not gonna even a discussion. I'm not gonna go with a discussion with a pro-military who think that we should put people in jail for the good of the country. That is not even a discussion. So I'm really sick and tired of just like trying to reach out for those people. The only way is to dominate these people, and the way to dominate them is through voting and to actually vote them out of office. But otherwise, there is no point.
Let me ask you this. I don't want to quote you from your book. You write this in the book. It's right toward the end. I can firmly state that in all the possible outcomes for our universe, the one remaining constant is that the Arab world will always be
Yeah, that was a good satirical ending for the
It was a good satirical ending. I'm wondering if you actually believe that.
It's going to be for a long time.
Yeah.
And the reason for it, that it is complex. So, for example, the problem is that the Arab world has so many powers entrenched into it and so many interests and up people from outside the Arab world. You have like ideology and you have like imperialism and you have like Russia and you have America and you have Israel and you have Saudi Arabia and you have all the radical Islam and you have like the people who want to keep the military. And I think I hate to say this, but there is a blood tax that the Arab world has not paid yet. With all of the suffering that we had, we didn't have something as big as the Second World War II. The Second World War with 50 million people were killed. And it's horrible. And I know, I know that people will hate me for this, but really, Europe is Europe that we know today because of that suffering. And you need to actually destroy everything and build everything from the ground up. And it's horrible to say that because I still have family living there. But what was happening in the past 30 or 40 years is just like you're patching things up and it doesn't really need to patch. And the power that be, the military power, are very strong. I mean, you've seen what happened in Syria. The guy burned down the whole country in order to stay in power. Maybe there you need destruction, and out of destruction there will be like a new order. And I'm not advocating for this, and I'm not wishing that to happen. I'm just looking at history. Like you had like a destructive civil war that happened for 5 years in America in order to have kind of the America that you had today. But they went through wars, through destructions in order to get. And this is how civilization are built. And maybe you need to see suffering in order to see resolution. But again, I don't wish it, but I don't know how else it can change. Because the people in power, people who have been in religious power and in military power, they're not going to give it up. Why would they give it up? And we've seen. Bashar Assad gave the perfect example. He gave a lesson to every other dictator in this country that, like, you can burn down the country, you can kill your own people, and still the international community will support you because they don't like the alternative.
It's interesting that you that seems so pessimistic.
It is. But, I'm sorry.
But that's the thing. Like, one of the things you talk about is that the people who, the tens of millions of people who watched the show, did so because it, not, you say, because it was funny necessarily, even though it was, but because it was hopeful. Like, they saw hope.
Absolutely. But what does hope do without power?
Yeah.
You know, yes, you have all of these ideas, and then you're either, now the young people either want to leave or want to just, like, stay in the corner and not do anything. You can't. I mean, you have all of these power, and then you go out and you want to create and do something, and then people who come knocking on your door take you to prison. So I know that the revolution was a necessary step in order for people to rethink everything. And what I'm saying is that, at least if that apocalyptic scenario happens, at least now you have people with a different mindset that they can build differently. If you have, like, the apocalypse with the same mindset, it's not going to make any difference.
Well, it's something you said was that satire ends at the screen. Like, satire is the first part, right? You get them thinking, and then they've got to go and act, I suppose.
I mean, because the same thing with activism. I mean, you had a lot of people who were going into a women's march in L.A. Amazing, 750,000 people, 750,000. And then there was, like, local election, only 12% showed up. You can't really win elections and you win power by funny slogans or memes or funny signs and jokes. And there's a limit to satire, and there's a limit to jokes and comedy.
It seems like one of the themes you've been thinking a bit about is the influence of money. I mean, you've already talked a bit about it. You talk about there's the history with the United States government. Essentially, I think these were your words, buying the loyalty of certain governments in the Middle East, for example, and how that empowers them. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now, the Trump administration's reaction to the Khashoggi murder.
Trump didn't do anything new. I'm sorry to say this, but the many American administrations have been always Saudi's bitch. I'm sorry to say this, you know. And King Abdullah, when he died, his funeral had every single American candidate, every single American president, past and current, coming to his funeral. You never see that anywhere. There was McCain, there was Obama, there was Hillary, there was Trump. They all went to his funeral. Why? You know, he's not like a reformer or anything. Saudi Arabia is a backward, radically extremist country who was actually one of the big reason why radical Islam has done, by the way, with the sponsorship of the United States. But they have paid, and this actually started with Afghanistan, in order to face the Soviet Union. The only way to do it, to get paid, is to just, like, funnel money to these radical people. And, like, what did you expect when the Soviet Union would leave? Well, these people, what, to just, like, sit down and open casinos? No, they turned into the Qaeda and into ISIS. All of that came from there. But the thing is, it just, like, it, and it's not just the United States, by the way. You find France, Germany, United Kingdom, they bend backwards. This is how they do it. They blackmail whatever dictator in the Middle East, and they use all of this rhetoric of, like, human rights, we don't accept that. And that happens until the first arms deal that he goes and sign. And once he pay, he's our friend. Which is extremely hypocritical. So, and it's just like, again, it's expected to see that in the Arab world and the Middle East because these are dictators. But, like, it just, like, bugs me when you see all of these Western democracy that talk about, like, human rights and democracies day and night, and with just, like, with a flash of a dollar, they just, like, switch. It just, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing, and it's insulting. And it's insulting to our intelligence. It's not really about, like, killing one journalist. It's this is just like a result of every. The only thing is that Trump, in this case, Trump is really saying it how it is. He's not being diplomatic. He's just being out there. He's just like saying what his American administration has done over all through the years. Yemen, the Yemen war didn't really start under Trump. It started under Obama, right? And the interference in Syria started under Obama. And the human rights violations goes back until the 50s. So it's depressing. It's depressing that to come here from the leader of the world and the biggest democracy in the world and all of these amazing slogans that we hear from Western democracy, but then, again, it's all about the money, which is it's really sad.
You think you could go back to Egypt?
I can. I don't think I can. I mean, I think it's there's no guarantee for anything.
Does that make you sad?
Yeah, but I'm dealing with this right now. I'm dealing with being here. I don't reminisce too much about like going back because it's counterproductive. This is like a new life for me here now. And a lot of people ask me, "Do you miss Egypt?" And I tell them very sadly, "Well, the Egypt I miss is not there anymore." So now I'm looking forward instead of just like wasting time of looking back.
Bassem Youssef, his book is Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring. We recorded the conversation at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Molly Wheeler, to Brooke Donner, Nick Cockrell, and the rest of the staff at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We had technical direction from Lewis Downey. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.